So research shows that the majority of software modernization failures, they don't actually happen because the code was buggy or, because the cloud servers randomly went down.
Right. It's usually a human error first.
Exactly. They fail the very moment a business leader buys like a shiny new technology before they actually define the organizational problem they're trying to solve.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, making technology decisions for an enterprise in 2026, it means navigating incredibly tight budgets, zero trust security expectations,
And a
and
marketplace that is just full of vendors promising to completely revolutionize your workflow.
yeah, exactly. Promising the moon. And if you are the one sitting in the driver's seat, making these calls for your organization, the operational risk resting on your shoulders is just massive.
It really is. So today's deep dive is zeroing in on a document that tackles this exact crisis. It's titled The Cloud Application Modernization Checklist: When to Rebuild, Refactor, or Retire.
And it's worth noting, while this text is specifically aimed at Orange County business leaders, the strategic framework it builds is completely universal.
Oh, totally. For
Yeah.
anyone leading a tech transition anywhere.
Yeah.
So our mission today is to give you the tools to slow down your internal decision-making process just enough to, demand evidence, expose the hidden risks, and avoid locking your company into a platform that will just slowly bleed your resources dry.
That's the goal. Stop the bleeding before it starts.
Right. Okay. Let's unpack this because looking at the source material, a checklist like this implies there is a recurring trigger, People don't go looking for modernization frameworks unless something in their current architecture is fundamentally breaking.
Yeah, they are usually feeling an operational gap that has just, well, it's grown too large to ignore, and it manifests in very specific ways.
Like what? What's the main catalyst?
A huge one is an accumulation of weak documentation over several years. You have a legacy system running a critical part of the business, but the original architects left like 3 years ago.
Oh, wow. So nobody knows how it works.
Literally, nobody internally actually knows how the database routing works anymore. It's terrifying for a business.
I can imagine.
And another major trigger is vendor lock-in built on blind trust. A leadership team will wake up one day and realize their current software provider dictates their data access, dictates their scaling costs.
And the company has essentially surrendered control of its own internal infrastructure.
Exactly. They don't own their own house anymore.
Well, the natural reflex when you're, bleeding time and money is to reach for a tourniquet. You want a tool to stop the bleeding immediately.
Right, but the source identifies that reflex as the single most dangerous trap in technology management. They call it the tool-first decision.
The tool-first trap.
Yeah. A leadership team feels the operational pain, and within a week, they are sitting through demos of cloud dashboards and, slick software interfaces.
Which feels productive, right? You're looking at solutions.
It feels productive, but it's backwards. The core thesis of this checklist is that you must ruthlessly define the exact business outcome, the specific process you are improving or the compliance risk you are mitigating before you ever look at a single piece of software.
That makes me think of a manufacturing floor.
Okay, how so?
A tool-first approach is like buying a massive state-of-the-art robotic conveyor system just because it's the fastest model on the market.
No.
But you do it before you even know what size boxes you're shipping or where your loading docks are located.
That's a great analogy. The conveyor belt itself works perfectly,
I mean,
but.
it's fundamentally useless for your actual floor plan.
Exactly. But let's look at this from the perspective of a CFO or an operations director. In the real world, buying popular off-the-shelf software and just tweaking your internal company workflows to match it, that's frequently the path of least resistance.
Right, I was just going to say, why wouldn't an organization just adapt its processes to fit a highly rated tool? It seems faster and cheaper.
Well, because forcing human behavior to accommodate a software interface creates immediate invisible friction across the entire company.
Invisible friction.
Yeah. When you purchase a tool and then demand that your workforce changes their fundamental daily operations to serve the tool's limitations, adoption stalls, employees just find workarounds.
Oh, like shadow IT.
Exactly, shadow IT. They build these rogue structures using personal cloud drives or random spreadsheets just to get their actual jobs done.
Right, because the official tool is too clunky for their specific need.
You've got it. So, to prevent that entire downward spiral, the source demands that leadership teams pause. They have to force the organization to answer 4 non-negotiable questions for every single modernization project.
Okay, let's break those down because they seem designed to act as an internal audit before a single dollar is spent. Question 1 is demanding evidence to support the recommendation.
Right. It strips away assumptions. You cannot base a massive platform shift on a feeling that an old system is just, quote unquote, clunky.
So what kind of evidence are we talking about?
The evidence must be quantitative.
Yeah.
Like, how many hours are lost to manual data entry? What is the specific latency of the current server? It has to be measurable.
Got it. Okay, then question 2 asks, who owns the outcome after launch? And I assume we aren't just asking who the project manager is during the rollout.
No, not at all. We are asking which specific executive's bonus is tied to this system actually working 6 months from now.
Oh, wow. Put some real skin in the game.
Exactly. Accountability. Yeah. Then question 3 focuses on risk management. What risks should be handled before implementation begins?
I imagine that's about cleaning house before you move.
Hmm.
Like, you don't want to migrate corrupted data into a pristine new database.
Right. Or failing to audit your compliance requirements before you shift customer data to a public cloud. That could be a legal disaster.
Definitely. And then question 4 requires you to define how success will be measured at the 30, 60, and 90-day marks.
Those intervals are so crucial because it forces the leadership team to set their pass-fail metrics while they are still objective.
You're committing to a yardstick before you become emotionally invested in the new tool's success.
Exactly. Before the sunk cost fallacy kicks in.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because once you have defined your outcome and answered those 4 internal questions, you actually have to go out into the market and evaluate your options.
And that is where things get tricky.
Right. The source outlines a mandatory 2026 scorecard for vendor evaluation, and it completely bypasses the typical sales marketing fluff.
It does. The framework shifts the power dynamic back to the buyer. The scorecard evaluates categories like, you know, capability, security, scalability, implementation quality, and cost transparency.
But the mechanism that makes this scorecard actually effective is the requirement for tangible evidence, right?
Yes, tangible evidence is everything. When evaluating a vendor's implementation quality, for example, you do not accept a slick slide deck promising a smooth transition.
What do you ask for instead?
You demand to see the actual sanitized workflow diagrams from their last 3 migrations. You ask for the specific step-by-step rollout documentation they use when a migration fails midway through.
You want the structural blueprints.
Exactly. If they are relying purely on concept art and verbal reassurances, that is a massive red flag.
And speaking of red flags, the source highlights a few critical warning signs when evaluating vendor responses. A vague scope of work is an obvious one. But hidden maintenance pricing is where companies really get trapped.
No, it's a huge trap.
Why are vendors so incentivized to bury those ongoing costs during the initial pitch?
Well, it is entirely about making the initial capital expenditure look palatable to your finance department. They will present a highly competitive baseline price for the software license, but they obfuscate the rest.
Obfuscate the API costs.
Yeah, the cost of API calls, data storage overages, or the mandatory annual support contracts. By year 2, your total cost of ownership has doubled, but you're already locked into their ecosystem.
That's brutal.
The source also points to a lack of a rollback plan as an immediate disqualifier. If a vendor cannot clearly explain the technical mechanics of how they will revert your systems to their previous state, if the new implementation crashes on day 1,
then what?
The meeting should end. Period.
Wow. Okay.
And what's fascinating here is the concept the scorecard refers to as exit readiness.
Exit readiness. I like that term.
Yeah. There's a deep paradox embedded in this criterion. The most effective way to determine if you should hire a technology partner is to aggressively interrogate them on how you can fire them.
So basically asking them for the divorce papers before you even sign the marriage certificate.
Conceptually, yes. You ask the vendor, if we terminate this contract in 2 years, what format is our data exported in? Do we retain ownership of the custom API integrations you built for us?
What does the administrative credential handoff look like? That sort of thing.
Exactly. A highly capable, trustworthy partner will have an exit packet ready to show you because they rely on their service quality to keep your business.
Right. And a bad partner. A predatory vendor will become evasive, or they will bury you in proprietary data formats that make leaving technically impossible.
It is the ultimate test of control because, I mean, if it costs you $1 million in engineering hours just to extract your own customer data from their platform, you don't actually own your data.
You're just renting it.
Now, beyond the scorecard, The source suggests a highly interactive question to ask vendors when you're comparing two finalists side by side.
This is one of my favorite parts of the checklist.
Yeah, you ask them, what specific scenarios would cause you to pause this implementation? Or what elements of our legacy system would you avoid migrating right away?
It is brilliant because it forces the vendor to reveal their risk tolerance and their technical maturity.
How so?
Well, weak vendors, desperate for the contract, will tell you they can migrate everything concurrently with zero downtime. No problems at all.
Which is never true. Never. Strong partners will acknowledge architectural reality. They will tell you, for example, that they are explicitly carving the legacy payroll database out of phase one because the data mapping is just too complex.
Right, and attempting it alongside the main migration puts the entire timeline at risk.
Exactly. They're willing to limit the initial scope to guarantee stability.
You want a vendor who is confident enough to tell you what they are bad at,
mm-hmm.
or what's too risky.
Definitely.
But, you know, even if you use the scorecard perfectly, you dodge the hidden maintenance fees, you get a solid answer on exit readiness, you find a transparent partner, the force makes it very clear that the project can still collapse entirely.
Oh, absolutely. Vendor selection is only half the equation. If your internal teams lack structural discipline, the best vendor in the world is just operating in a vacuum.
Right. The checklist mandates a strict, four-part internal ownership model for any major modernization effort.
And this is non-negotiable.
Let's use a construction analogy here. Because if you're building a skyscraper, you don't just hire a general contractor and walk away.
Yeah.
You need a load-bearing architecture of leadership on your side to make sure the building doesn't collapse.
I love that. And the foundation of that architecture is the executive sponsor.
Who is that, usually?
This is the individual who controls the budget and has the organizational authority to smash through red tape when the project hits a bureaucratic wall.
Got it. The muscle.
Exactly. Resting on that foundation is the business owner. They are the architect holding the blueprint. They define the specific business outcomes we discussed earlier, ensuring the technology actually serves the company's strategic goals.
Then you have the technical owner. They are the structural engineers looking at the actual steel framing.
Right. They are the ones validating the feasibility, asking how the new cloud application is physically going to interface with the 10-year-old local servers the company still relies on.
And finally, the operational reviewer. This role focuses purely on the day-to-day utility.
Yeah. They are the ones testing the workflows to ensure that the customer service team can actually process a return in the new system without needing to click through, like, 15 separate submenus.
Which happens all the time. But wait, I have to push back here. This internal model makes total sense for a massive Fortune 500 company.
Sure.
But what if you're an 80-person logistics firm or a mid-sized marketing agency? You don't have the administrative headcount to assign four distinct executives to a single software upgrade. Does this entire organizational framework just collapse for smaller businesses?
That's a great question. And no, it doesn't collapse. The framework scales down by consolidating the roles. But the critical distinction is that the responsibilities cannot be merged.
What do you mean by that?
So in a smaller operation, the CEO might act as both the executive sponsor and the business owner. The lead systems engineer might handle both the technical owner and operational reviewer duties.
Okay, so people are wearing multiple hats.
Right. But when that engineer is evaluating a software feature, they must consciously recognize whether they are assessing it for technical stability or for operational usability. If those responsibilities blur together, critical requirements just fall through the cracks.
So it's really about compartmentalizing the decision-making process.
Exactly. You have to know which hat you're wearing at any given moment.
But even with a perfectly balanced internal team, there is a massive vulnerability. What happens when the technical owner, the only person who genuinely understands the custom routing between the new cloud tool and the old database, gets poached by a competitor midway through the rollout?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, that vulnerability is exactly why the source heavily emphasizes the concept of the documentation shield.
Documentation shield.
Yeah. In modern IT, documentation is rarely treated with the respect it deserves. It is often viewed as, you know, tedious administrative work that just gets rushed at the very end of a project.
Well, for sure. It's the last thing anyone wants to do.
But a rigorous documentation process is fundamentally an organizational shield. It is literal armor against employee churn, vendor pivots, and system failures.
Explain the mechanics of that armor. How does a stack of architecture diagrams actually protect the company's bottom line?
Well, it creates institutional memory that exists independent of any single employee or vendor. The checklist requires comprehensive decision notes, detailed architecture diagrams, change histories, and access ownership records.
So if things go wrong, you aren't flying blind.
Exactly. If your primary database crashes at 2 in the morning, your recovery team isn't guessing how the API gateways were configured. They are reading the exact routing logic from the documentation.
Right. Or if a vendor arbitrarily changes their pricing model, your documentation proves exactly what functionality you own, giving you the leverage to migrate away rapidly.
It separates the knowledge from the personnel. You are never held hostage by the one developer who holds all the passwords in their head.
That is so important. Now, let's say we have our defined outcome. The scorecard has vetted the vendor, our internal leadership is structured, and we are documenting every decision.
Sounds like a dream scenario.
Right. But the final hurdle is the actual execution. How do these projects structurally fail during the rollout, particularly regarding timelines and budgets?
Well, the most destructive budgetary trap is a failure to understand the mechanics of total cost. Leadership teams routinely select the proposal with the lowest initial estimate.
Because it looks great to the finance team.
Always. But they only discover later that the lowest estimate was achieved by stripping out the essential components of a secure transition.
What gets stripped out usually?
A realistic functional budget must explicitly line item the hidden mechanics. Things like comprehensive quality assurance testing, third-party security audits of the new architecture, deep employee training programs, and dedicated post-launch operational support.
And if those items aren't on the estimate, you aren't saving money. You are just deferring the cost until the system breaks down in production.
Exactly. You'll pay for it eventually, and usually a lot more.
So to manage that risk, the source insists on abandoning the Big Bang rollout in favor of a strictly phased roadmap.
Yes. You never just flip a giant switch. The required roadmap begins with a highly constrained discovery review, lasting no more than 1 to 3 weeks.
Just a few weeks.
Yeah, this phase is purely an audit of the baseline architecture and priority ranking. From there, you move into a tightly controlled proof of concept or, you know, a small-scale pilot.
And the functional purpose of that pilot phase isn't just to see if the software turns on. It is to expose systemic risk in a contained environment before you roll it out to 1,000 users.
Right. It's a sandbox. And that philosophy drives the absolute centerpiece of this execution strategy, the strict 90-day success plan.
Let's talk about that 90-day timeline because it seems critical.
It acts as a powerful forcing function against scope creep. Endless, open-ended modernization projects drain capital and destroy morale. The structure is rigid for a reason.
How is it broken down?
Days 1 through 30 are dedicated solely to mapping the current state and identifying the priority gaps. No implementation happens here.
Okay, just mapping.
Then, days 31 through 60 are the pilot window. You implement the single highest value improvement. You isolate one variable.
So what does this all mean? It means the final window, days 61 through 90, is a hard stop.
A completely hard stop.
It is a mandatory review period where leadership evaluates the raw metrics from the pilot, documents the friction points, and makes an objective decision. They either scale the deployment, adjust the technical approach, or kill the project entirely.
Yes. It provides an off-ramp before the costs become unrecoverable. And measuring that progress requires real discipline. You cannot wait until day 90 to decide what success looks like.
You have to know the target.
Right. The metrics, whether that is a 30% reduction in server latency or eliminating 4 manual steps in a data entry workflow, must be locked in before the pilot even begins.
But, you know, even with a phased rollout and a strict 90-day timeline, human behavior can still derail the technology.
Oh, human behavior is the biggest wild card.
The source calls out a few classic execution failures, like skipping user acceptance testing because the engineers assume the interface is intuitive. But there is one failure it labels as the ultimate sin of modernization.
Yes. The most damaging error an organization can make is leaving the legacy workflows running simultaneously alongside the new system.
This happens constantly. A company spends millions migrating to a sophisticated cloud platform, but middle management is still secretly exporting data and emailing Excel spreadsheets back and forth to run their actual departments.
They do it all the time, and the behavioral economics of that situation just guarantee failure. Change requires effort, and if you leave the old, familiar path open, employees will always take the path of least resistance.
It's just human nature.
Exactly. Running parallel systems creates immediate data silos. It introduces severe security vulnerabilities because data is moving outside the new secure architecture. And it mathematically ensures you are paying the licensing and maintenance costs for two separate platforms.
So a successful rollout structurally requires you to sever the old pathways. You have to pull the plug on the old way.
I have to burn the boats.
So to bring this all together and put it into practice for you listening, if you are staring down a major technology transition, stop shopping for software. Document the specific operational gap in your current state to find the exact business outcome you need.
And build an internal roadmap that assigns distinct ownership roles, sets a firm timeline, and establishes your baseline metrics before a single line of code is changed or a single license is purchased.
Right. And for organizations in Southern California, the source material explicitly recommends leveraging Technisian to help build these phased roadmaps. They have the technical depth to scope the requirements, run the upfront security reviews, and execute comprehensive Microsoft 365 or custom software assessments. They essentially act as the operational bridge between your business goals and the final vendor selection.
You know, this raises an important question, though, and it touches on the invisible friction we've been circling around this entire discussion.
What's that?
When we look at that ultimate sin, the refusal to turn off the old broken workflows, we really have to consider the psychology of modernization. Why is organizational change so fundamentally difficult?
That is the million-dollar question.
Even when an optimized, highly efficient, fully funded system is deployed right in front of them, what is it about human nature that makes professionals cling so fiercely to the manual, inefficient processes that they literally complain about every single day?
Wow. It's a powerful realization.
Yeah.
The most complex legacy system you have to overwrite isn't actually sitting on a server rack. It's the ingrained habits of the people walking your hallways.
Exactly.
It makes you realize that successful technology modernization is ultimately an exercise in human psychology. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep scrutinizing those vendor scorecards, demand the evidence, and we will catch you on the next one.